Chapter 2 The Ferry Ship. I was introduced that evening at dinner to Mr. Harlan's physician and also to his private secretary. I found Dr. Braille interesting in a solemn way. He was dark, slim, clean-shaven, and of middle age. He had brown eyes and sleek black hair that he brushed carefully and parted down the middle. His manner was quiet and self-contained, yet I got the impression that he was fully alive to the advantages of being the traveling medical advisor to an American millionaire. I have not mentioned till now that Morton Harlan was American. I was always rather in the habit of forgetting the fact, for he had long ago forsworn his nationality and naturalized himself a British subject. But he had made his vast fortune in America, and was still the controlling magnet of many large financial interests in the United States. He was now much more English than American, for he had been educated at Oxford, and as a young man had always associated with English society and English ways. He had married an English wife, who died when their first child, Catherine, was born, and he was wont to set down all of Miss Catherine's mopish languors to a delicacy inherited from her mother, as well as to the lack of a mother's care in childhood. In my opinion, Catherine was not really ailing, but it was evident that she had been given her own way from a very early age, and had become so accustomed to being allowed to exaggerate every little ailment that she had made the most of an opportunity to grow up accepting ill health as the best way of getting attention. Dr. Braille, I soon perceived, also made the most of her attitude. I was covertly amused by the subtle gleam in his eyes as, during pauses in the conversation, he glanced rapidly from father to daughter. He seemed to me to watch them as narrowly as a cat might watch a couple of unwary mice. The secretary, Mr. Swinton, was a pale, precise-looking young man with a somewhat servile demeanor, under which I could see that he concealed an inordinately good opinion of himself. His ideas were centered in and bounded by the art of stenography. I suppose that if all one wanted was a secretary, he was the perfect choice. I spoke little at the table, trying to feel my surroundings and to understand where I might insert myself to be a suitable guest. All this time I felt, rather than saw, Dr. Braille regarding me with a kind of perplexity. My presence there seemed to irritate him, though he didn't show irritation, and I was unable to perceive the cause of his annoyance. As for Mr. Swinton, he was comfortably wrapped up in a pachydermous hide of self-appreciation, so that I believe he thought nothing about me one way or the other, except as a guest of his patron, and one to whom he was therefore bound to be civil. But with Dr. Braille it was otherwise. It puzzled him, and after a brief study of me, I became an irritant. He forced himself to converse with me, however, and at first we interchanged the usual remarks on the weather and on the various beauties of the coast along which we were sailing.
"I see that you like fine scenery," he said finally. "Have you tried your hand at art?"
"No," and I smiled. He seemed surprised. So I added, "Is imitation important to admiration?"
"It should be," he answered, with a little bow, "considering that so many of the paintings men paint are of your sex."
I made no answer. Mr. Harlan looked at me with a somewhat quizzical air.
"You don't believe in compliments?" he asked.
"Was it a compliment?" I asked. Dr. Braille's dark brows drew together in a slight frown. With that expression, he looked rather like an Italian poisoner of old times, the kind of man whom Caesar Borgia might have employed to give the happy dispatch to his enemies by some sure and undiscoverable means known only to intricate chemistry. Presently, Mr. Harlan spoke again, peeling a pear slowly and delicately, with deft movements of his fruit knife that suggested flaying alive some poor sentient creature.
"Our little friend is of a rather strange disposition," he observed. "She has the indifference of an old-world philosopher to socially agreeable speeches. Her soul is ardent, but her mind is suspicious. She is aware that pleasant words are often spoken to cover treacherous intentions. If a man is as rude and blunt as myself, for example, she prefers him to be rude and blunt, rather than attempt to conceal his roughness by any amiability which is not his nature to feel. Here he looked up at me from a careful scrutiny of his nearly flayed pair. "Isn't that so?" "Why, certainly," I replied. "But is that such a strange or original attitude?" The corners of his cynical mouth curled upward on one side.
"Pardon me, dear lady, it is strange. The normal and strictly reasonable attitude of the human pygmy is to accept as gospel everything it is told of a nature soothing and agreeable to itself. Man, pygmy that he is, believes among other presumptions that he has a special place in this universe. He is destined to be immortal, and considers that he shares even now with God his divine intelligence. Upset by the merest trifle, troubled by every little setback, driven to howling by a toothache, and generally unable to face the least adversity, he imagines himself entitled anyway to some sort of kinship with the divine. What marvelous presumption! What magnificent arrogance!"
I remained silent, but I could almost hear my heart beating with suppressed emotion. I knew Morton Harlan was an atheist, so far as atheism is possible to any creature capable of feeling at all. But I had not expected him to state his opinions so openly and so rudely on the very first evening of my stay on board his yacht. He knew I had deep faith in God. It occurred to me that perhaps he had spoken this way for his own amusement, or for that of the other two men present, in the hope of moving me to an answering argument. I was startled by his incivility, but it is not my nature to argue. I therefore did what was incumbent upon me in such a situation. I held my peace. Dr. Braille watched me curiously, and poor Catherine Harlan turned her plaintive eyes upon me in alarm. She had learned to dread her father's fondness for religious argument. But as I did not speak, Mr. Harland was placed in the embarrassing position of someone propounding a theory that no one has any desire to contest. Why, I wondered, after his gracious invitation to me in London, had he decided now to be so rude? Was it the influence of Dr. Braille's company? Had he so little command of his own behavior? Had his real motive been all along, perhaps to treat me as a foil for his cynicism? It seemed to be a better person than that. Looking slightly confused now, he went on in a lighter and more casual way. "I had a friend once at Oxford, a good fellow, I now think. He was a little like our friend here, full of odd fancies. I suppose it is she who brought him to my mind this evening. And I was reflecting on the reaction to him that many of us other students have. Forgive me for my sharpness with you." Here he turned to me. "This man was one of those who believe not only in God, but in the divine in man. Most of us judged him peculiar. His father had lived by choice in some desert corner of Egypt for 40 years, and it was in Egypt that this boy had been born. Of his mother he never spoke. His father died suddenly, leaving him a large fortune under trustees till he came of age, with instructions that he was to be taken to England and educated at Oxford. When he came into possession of his money, he was to be left free to do with it as he liked. I met him when he was almost halfway through his university course. I was only 2 or 3 years his senior, but he always looked much younger than I, yet he seemed much more mature. To most of us, he seemed uncanny, a little like our little friend here." Here he indicated me by a nod of his head, and smiled in a way that seemed intended to be kindly, though in fact his smile only emphasized his sour nature. "This man, I'm remembering him more clearly now, never practiced or trained for anything. And yet everything came to him very easily.
His faith wasn't the church-going sort. There was something unreal about it. And he would sit in silence for hours on end, an unusual practice that made him seem even more peculiar to the rest of us. He was good at sports and friendly enough, but there was always a sort of aura about him of remoteness. He was good at his studies. He smiled readily enough. But there was always this nimbus of remoteness. It was nothing you could put your finger on. For some reason, many of us came to fear him. Looking back, I think it was that he didn't share in our pleasures, gambling, for example, and drinking. Moreover, he paid no attention to our opinions about things. Though I belonged to his college and was constantly thrown into association with him, I became infected with the general unease about him. One night, he stopped me in the quadrangle where he had his rooms. Here Mr. Harlan broke off suddenly. "Am I boring you?" he asked. "I really have no business inflicting the recollections of my youth upon any of you."
Dr. Braille's brown eyes showed a sort of detached interest.
Pray go on," he urged. "It sounds like a chapter from some medieval romance."
"I don't believe in fiction," said Mr. Harlan grimly. "Facts are quite enough without embroidery."
This fellow was a fact, a healthy, energetic, living fact. Anyway, as I was saying, he stopped me in the quadrangle and laid his hand on my shoulder. I shrank from his touch, feeling a restless desire to get away from him.
"What's the matter with you, Harlan?"
he asked in a voice peculiarly his own.
"You seem afraid of me. Why so? I've done you no harm, nor have I ever wished you any."
I shuffled my feet on the stone pavement, not knowing what to say. Then I stammered out the foolish excuses young men make when they find themselves in an awkward corner. He listened to my stammering remarks about the other fellows with attentive patience, then took his hand from my shoulder with a quick, decisive movement.
"Look here, Harlan," he said. "You are blindly accepting all the conventions and traditions that encrust our poor old alma mater. They stick out all over you like burrs. Remember, they'll cling to you. I'm sad to see you choose this way. I'm starting at the other end, where education ends and life begins."
I suppose I stared at him, for he went on,
"I mean true life, which goes forward, not the dead life found in universities, where stale crumbs are picked over that have fallen for centuries. That banquet has been finished and history has passed on. There, I won't detain you. We shall not meet often, but please don't forget what I said."
"I don't understand what you're saying," I blurted out angrily. "What of the other fellows? They think you're queer."
He smiled. "Bless them all," he said. "They're in the same boat with you. They think me queer because they are queer. That is to say, they are out of line with themselves."
I was irritated by his indifference and asked him what he meant by out of line.
"Suppose you see a garden beautifully and harmoniously planned," he answered, still smiling, "and some clumsy fellow comes along and puts a pigsty in the middle of it. Wouldn't you call that out of line? Wouldn't it be, to say the least, unsuitable?"
"Oh," I said hotly, "so you consider me and my friends pigsties in your landscape?" He made a half-apologetic gesture and answered,
"Something of the sort, dear boy. But don't worry. The pigsty is always a popular building in the world you will live in."
With that, he bade me good night and left me fuming. Yes, I was angry, for I thought myself and my associates the very cream of Oxford. But it was he who took all the highest honors that year. And then, when he graduated, he utterly vanished, so to speak. I have never seen or heard of him again.
Mr. Hartland's face assumed a smug expression.
"I suppose his studies led him nowhere. He must be elderly now. He may be lame, blind, lunatic, or more probably still dead. I don't even know why I thought of him just now, except that his views on life were so much like those of our little friend."
Again he indicated me with a nod.
He never cared for agreeable speeches, always rather mistrusted social conventions, and queerest of all, he believed in a higher life after death.
Or a lower, I put in quietly.
Ah, yes, there must be a downgrade, of course, if there is an up. But as I accept neither, the point is irrelevant.
I looked at him. I suppose my looks expressed wonder or pity or both, for he averted his glance from mine.
You are something of a theosophist, I believe, Dr. Braille said, lifting his eyes from scrutiny of the tablecloth and fixing them on me.
Not at all, I answered. I am not an ist of any kind. I believe in being true to what I have actually experienced.
Yet those who practice science also are ists, Mr. Swinton pointed out primly.
I smiled. In their ism, I said, they often become as dogmatic as any priest. Science, like everything else, has its borderland, from which the brain can easily slip off into chaos. The most approved scientific professors are liable thus to end their speculations. They forget that in order to understand the infinite, they must first be sure of the infinite in themselves.
You speak like an oracle, my dear, said Mr. Harlan. But despite your sage utterances, man remains as finite as ever.
If he chooses to be finite in his thinking, he certainly will remain so, I replied. Mr. Harlan seemed desirous of continuing the argument, but I determined to say no more and began to speak of our cruise. The topic he had raised was too sacred for me to encourage its light discussion by persons whose mental attitude was antipathetic to it. After dinner, Miss Catherine claimed she was suffering from neuralgia. Gathering up her shawls and wraps, she asked me to excuse her for going to bed early. I bade her good night, and also, leaving my host and the other two men to their smoke, I went up on deck. We were anchored off Mull, and against a starlit sky of exceptional clearness, the dark mountains of Morven were outlined with the softness as of black velvet. The yacht rested on perfectly calm waters, shining like polished steel. The warm stillness of the summer night was soothing and restful. Our captain and one or two of the sailors were about on duty, and I sat in the stern of the vessel, looking up into the glorious heavens. The tapering bowsprit of the Diana pointed upward as if wishing to draw my attention toward the web of stars above. Soon, oblivious to my material surroundings, I lost myself in imaginary flight among those glittering specks, the suns, perhaps, of unknown worlds. And I thought, how could my companions, on this ephemeral cruise, overlook the evidence all around them of a governing intelligence in a universe so beautiful and so carefully ordered? How could they be so destitute of faith in God? They seem to have less perception of divinity than the humblest plant that forces its way instinctively up to the light. I marveled at this thought for a moment, then decided it was no use pursuing a line of thought that could change nothing. Then I found myself wondering about the story Mr. Harland had told us about his friend at Oxford. I tried to picture the man's face and figure. After a time, it seemed to me that I almost saw him. Indeed, I could have sworn that a man's shadowy form stood immediately in front of me, bending upon me a searching glance from eyes that were strangely familiar. Startled at this wraith of my own fancy, I half rose from my chair, then sank back again with a silent chuckle at the too vivid power of my imagination. A figure did certainly present itself, but one of sufficient bulk to convince me that it was no imagination. It was the captain of the Diana,
a cheery-looking person of thoroughly nautical type, who, approaching me, lifted his cap and said,
"That's a wonderfully fine yacht that has just dropped anchor behind us. She's illuminated, too. Have you seen her?"
"No," I answered, and turned in the direction he indicated. An involuntary exclamation escaped me. There, about half a mile to our rear, floated a schooner of exquisite proportions and fairy-like grace, outlined from stem to stern by a delicate display of electric light, as though decorated for some great festival. It made quite a shining spectacle in the deepening darkness of night. We could see active figures at work on deck. The sails were dropped and quickly furled, but the quivering radiance remained, running up every tapering mast and spar, so that the whole vessel seemed drawn on the dusky air with pencil points of fire. I stood up, gazing at the wonderful sight in silent amazement and admiration, the captain beside me. It was he who spoke first.
"I can't make her out," he said in perplexity. "We have heard no sound, except just when she dropped anchor, and that was almost noiseless. How she came around the point yonder so suddenly is a mystery. I was keeping a sharp lookout, too."
"Surely she's very large for a sailing vessel," I queried.
"The largest I've ever seen," he replied. "But how did she sail? That's what I want to know."
He looked so puzzled that I laughed. "Well, I suppose in the usual way," I said, "with sails."
"Aye, that's all very well."
He glanced at me with a look of compassion for someone who knew nothing about seafaring.
"Sails, however, must have wind, and there hasn't been a capful of it all day. Yet she came in with crowded canvas, as if there had been a regular sou'wester, and found her anchorage as easy as you please, all in a minute, too. If there was a wind, it wasn't a wind belonging to this world. Wouldn't Mr. Harlan perhaps like to see her?"
I took the hint and ran down into the saloon, which by this time had become filled with the stifling odors of smoke and whiskey. Mr. Harlan was there, drinking and talking somewhat excitedly with Dr. Braille about the non-existence of God, while his secretary listened and looked on. I explained why I had ventured to interrupt their conversation, and they accompanied me up on deck. The strange yacht looked more bewilderingly brilliant than ever, the heavens having clouded over somewhat, and as we all, the captain included, leaned over our own deck rail and gazed at her shining outlines, we heard the sound of delicious music and song floating across the quiet sea.
"Some millionaire's toy," said Mr. Harlan. "She's superbly built. Sailing ships are always more elegant than steam, though not half so useful. I expect she'll lie becalmed here for a day or two." "It's a wonder she got around here at all," said the captain. "There wasn't any wind to bring her here."
Mr. Harlan looked amused.
"There must have been some wind, Eric," he said with a laugh. "It just wasn't boisterous enough for a hardy salt like you to feel it."
"There wasn't a breath," declared Derek firmly. "Not enough to blow a baby's curl."
"Then how did she get here?"
asked Dr. Braille. Captain Derrick's lifted eyebrows expressed his inability to solve the enigma.
"I said just now if there was a wind, it wasn't a wind belonging to this world."
Mr. Harlan turned upon him quickly.
"Well, there are no winds belonging to other worlds that will ever disturb our atmosphere," he said crisply. "Come, come, Derek, you don't think that yacht is a ghost, do you? A sort of Flying Dutchman?"
Captain Derrick smiled broadly.
"No, sir, I don't. There's flesh and blood aboard anyway. I've seen the men hauling down canvas, so I know that. But the way she sailed in bothers me."
"Doesn't all that electric light seem rather ostentatious?" asked Dr. Braille. "I imagine the owner wants to advertise his riches."
"That doesn't follow," said Mr. Harland a little sharply. "I grant you we live in an advertising age. But I don't imagine the owner of that yacht is a new pill or a plaster or a special tea."
He may want to amuse himself. It may be the birthday of his wife or one of his children. There may be any one of several reasons for lighting up his vessel, and he may think no more of advertising than you or I."
"That's true," assented Dr. Braille with a quick concession to his patron's humor. "But people nowadays do so many queer things for mere notoriety's sake that one can hardly avoid suspecting them. Some will even kill themselves in order to be talked about.
Fortunately, they don't hear what is said about them for having done so,"
returned Mr. Harland,
"or they might change their minds and remain alive. It is hardly worthwhile to hang yourself to be called a fool."
While this talk went on, I remained silent, watching the illuminated schooner with absorbed fascination. Suddenly, as I was still gazing at her, every spark with which she was bejeweled went out, and only the ordinary lamps common to the watches of the night on board a vessel at anchorage burned dimly here and there, like red winking eyes. For the rest, she was hardly visible, save an indistinct black outline. The swiftness with which her brilliancy had been eclipsed startled us all, and drew an exclamation of surprise from Captain Derrick.
"What pantomimists call a quick change," observed Mr. Harland with a laugh. "The show is over for the night. Let us turn in. Tomorrow morning we'll try to make acquaintance with the owner, and find out for Captain Derrick's comfort how she manages to sail without wind."
We bade each other good night then and descended to our several quarters. When I found myself alone in my luxurious suite, the first thing I did was open one of the portholes and listen to the music floating from the mysterious yacht. It was a music full of haunting sweetness and rhythmic melody, and I was not sure whether it came from stringed instruments or from singing voices. By climbing up on the sofa in my sitting room, I could look out through the porthole on the near sea rippling close by, and bringing with every ripple, as I fancied, a new cadence, a sweet and more tender snatch of tune. A subtle scent was on the salt air, as of roses mingling with the freshness of the scarcely moving waters. The scent came, I thought, from the beautiful blossoms which so lavishly adorned my rooms. From my point of observation, I could not see the yacht, but I could hear the music, and that was enough for my delight. Leaving the porthole open, I lay down on the sofa just beneath it and settled myself to listen. A soft breath from the sea now blew on my cheeks, and with every whiff the delicate vibrations of harmony rose and fell, as if the sounds were being played or sung for me alone. In a restful languor, I drowsed with my eyes open, losing myself in a cloud of happy dreams and fancies that came to me unbidden. Finally, the music died softly away, like a retreating wave, then ceased altogether. I waited a few minutes, listening breathlessly, lest it begin again, and I lose some note of it. Then, hearing no more, I softly closed the porthole and drew the curtain. I did this with an odd reluctance, feeling somehow that I had shut out a friend. It was nearly midnight. I had intended writing to Francesca, but I was now disinclined for anything but rest. The music which had so entranced me still throbbed in my ears, making my heart sing with joy. A warm sense of peace and comfort came over me when at last I lay down in my luxurious bed and slipped off into the land of sleep. Ah, what a wonderland! Often and often as I've made my entrance there, I have found in its enchanted precincts a million halls of as yet unvisited marvels. Among those halls I now found myself again, under a dome of the purest crystal. There, as I listened, someone invisible spoke to me of love.